This is The Real Story from the BBC. I'm Ritula Shah with your weekly deep dive into a story that's making news and changing lives. And this week, death, chaos and economic turmoil have trailed in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Governments have struggled to cope with the enormous challenges posed by the scale of the health and social crisis. But one key service has performed much more robustly than anyone expected right across the globe, and that's the internet.
Now they're going to be able to go on the Zoom classes and see their friends, and also they can access the actual work that's being set by the teachers.
I'm upstairs in our spare bedroom doing pre-recorded lessons or Zoom sessions.
Working from home at the moment, doing 2-hour on, 2-hour off shifts.
Online meetings, family gatherings, even funerals, singing and performance, teaching and health tracking. The internet has proved to be the key to weathering lockdowns and social isolation. But the World Wide Web is relatively new. It's been around for just 30 years. And before the pandemic, its creator had mixed views on its performance over those decades.
I think it's been a force for good for the first 15. Right now, I think it's really in the balance. I'm very concerned about nastiness and misinformation spreading. I think with a turnaround, a mid-course correction, I am then optimistic again.
But what might that course correction look like? Is now the time to pause and reflect on how it all works and whether this is the moment for some drastic reform?
If you're on Twitter and Facebook, you have to have accounts on both. People are trying to change that so that you can have one digital identity and use that to access anything.
That's a rattle through some of the big ideas we're going to encounter inside this digital palace. And it's interesting that we often talk about the problems we're facing with the internet as it is. You know, the spread of misinformation, anonymous trolls, political manipulation and so on. But we're less inclined to look at the architecture. Can we change the internet itself, how it works? Which might perhaps help to solve some of those problems. And that's what we want to talk about today. And the context is a positive moment. We've been pleasantly surprised by how digital connectivity has made dealing with the pandemic more bearable. So with all that in mind, let's meet our panel. Douglas Rushkoff is author of Team Human and is Professor of Media Studies at City University of New York, and he has his roots in the early cyberpunk culture, and that's going to be important to our conversation a little bit later on. But Douglas, first of all, let's begin with that good news. For you, during this pandemic, how do you think the internet has helped to bring out the best in humanity, sort of compassion and creativity, perhaps?
Well, in some ways, I think what it's done best is utility. And the things that made me the most hopeful, especially in the early stages of the pandemic, was looking at people using really simple tools like a Google Doc in order to get medical supplies to hospitals. So they would create a spreadsheet and you'd list the hospital and what supplies do they need and where do you leave it and who do you call. And so rather than like trying to make a new app, you know, or a new platform in order to do some new thing, people were just using the actual tools that were available to just get jobs done. You know, I think the sort of the human connection aspects of it are still lacking. And in some ways, it's great for people to see what the net can do and what it can't. But the willingness to just go down and dirty, in a sense, and use these simple utilities is encouraging to me.
That's a great thought. Actually, the limitations of some of that connectivity have become apparent too. It's been a very interesting time in the way we've used what's around us. Glenn Weil is Chief Technology Officer, political economist and social technologist at Microsoft Office, and founder of the Radical Exchange Foundation. Now, that's a global movement that's dedicated to reimagining the building blocks of democracy and markets in order to uphold fairness, plurality and meaningful participation in a rapidly changing world. Glenn Weil, do you think the internet has helped to bring out the best in humanity? Has it actually proved its worth during the pandemic?
I think, like most technologies, it's been used in awful ways and in great ways. I think one of the most compelling examples is the story of Taiwan, where not only during the pandemic, but in the run-up to it, the power of digital participation in democracy was used to deal with the misinformation problem. And then during the pandemic, because the information issues were addressed so effectively because many of these participatory platforms were used to build services, the country was able to actually avoid the worst of the pandemic and at the same time to actually more intensively than many countries that were isolated at home harness the web to allow people to govern themselves. And that's, I think, in large part because they have a culture of co-creation of digital services by citizens together with technologists, rather than the model we have in both China and the West of a very top-down, hierarchical, either corporate or state-led architecture.
Which again, I think is something I hope we're going to talk about today. David Baker is the former UK managing editor of the technology magazine Wired. He now presents programmes on BBC Radio and teaches at the School of Life, a global organisation that explores the subjects of human connection and resilience. David Baker, have there been some high points for you during this pandemic about the way in which the internet has worked and has been used by people?
Well, absolutely. And I think actually a high point has been a very low tech one in my experience. I mean, I've loved the way that the internet, and this is an obvious thing to say, has kept us connected. You know, that's the point of the internet. And all of us have enjoyed Zoom conversations with friends and families while we've been locked down and unable to meet people face to face. But something I've really been enjoying is something called Quarantine Chat, which is a little app you download and you just put in your phone number and the languages you speak. And then at a random time, sometime during the week, the phone rings and it connects you to just someone else somewhere in the world, also in lockdown, for a little conversation. And I've had wonderful conversations with people in New Zealand, in Mauritius, in Seattle, in Germany, in Slovenia, just connecting us in that random way, which really reminds me of the very early days of the internet, that way that we could discover a common purpose or a common conversation with someone that we never even knew existed. And that was the wonderful thing the internet gave us right at the beginning. And I'm really pleased to see that it's come to the fore to do that now.
Gosh, that's lovely. It's interesting that you've all talked about simplicity and cooperation. I think that's fascinating. Let's stay with this positive vibe for a little bit longer. What's the internet ever done for us? It's not all trolls and political skullduggery. And I'd like to go back in time and hear a bit more about the origins of the internet, the idealism that surrounded its founding and development. Professor Dame Wendy Hall is Regius Professor in Computer Science at the University of Southampton. She was part of the cohort of early internet pioneers. I asked her about the basic principles that underpin our online experiences.
Remember, the internet started in the 60s and 70s. The internet is about enabling computers to talk to each other. And that was set up in a time where nobody used computers. And so it was like, you know, a group of friends talking to each other on email and through the networks, people who respected each other and didn't want to abuse it. And then when Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web, then that sat on top of the internet. And the idea he picked up on, the ideals of the internet, was that the technical standards should be open and universal and free to use. But of course, because it's open and free and anyone can do anything with it, then people have used that, and not necessarily with malicious aims, but it's become abused because it's so quick to spread information to anyone you want to.
And just explain a little bit more how that was sort of built into the very structure.
The real basis for both the internet, the network of computers, and the World Wide Web, which is the way we communicate with the computers, enables us to, is that the technical standards, that is the messages that the computers and the computer networks use to talk to each other. How you write the software determines whether it's a service you want people to pay for or you're giving away for free in return for advertising.
And why was that so important, this idea that it should be open, universal?
The thesis is, and Tim used this thesis when he was building the World Wide Web, was that if you charge for it, not enough people would use it. And you don't really see the effect of the internet or the web until lots of people are using it. I mean, if you remember back in the early days of the web, there wasn't much on there. It wasn't really very interesting. Why would you buy a computer to use the World Wide Web? Now you can't imagine not having a computer, which is usually in your mobile phone, and you don't exist really unless you have a site on the website, whether you're a person or a company or a government. And that's changed in the last 30 years. And that's because everybody's using it. So you know that all your friends, you can communicate with them through this technology because they will be using it too. And it means also that companies know that when they're building something to work on those standards, they can sell it anywhere in the world, or give it away for free anywhere in the world.
Those foundational ideals, while we could argue about how they've been distorted, how people have monetized them, they remain intact. They are what's driving the internet even now.
Yes, absolutely. And that, I think we've seen that in the pandemic, because So far, the technical standards have held. If it wasn't for that, then we wouldn't be able to communicate with countries around the world. If that breaks, then that communication layer breaks and you wouldn't be able to easily send messages or sell products to other countries. And it isn't just, well, okay, well, let's cut China off, forget about China, we don't want to talk to them and we can talk to the rest of the world. But it doesn't work like that because China actually supports the use of the internet in many countries around the world, not just in China. And so, you know, if you decide, well, say China, for example, where we're not going to worry if they develop different standards, but you would have to worry because it would cut you off from other countries in Africa and other parts of the world. So we saw it in the pandemic, right? Governments use it to communicate. We can send messages about the DNA of the virus so that scientists around the world can start working on treatments and vaccines. You couldn't do that if you didn't have the open universal standards of the internet. China have tried to change it. They have proposed an alternative internet architecture. And so far, that has not been adopted by anyone, including China. But that threat is still there.
That's Dame Wendy Hall. So, Douglas Rushkoff, let's think about those ideals that she was talking about. Why were they so important? Were they consciously established?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, they were based on the biases of the technology. I mean, really, from the get-go, it was about sharing resources. Computing cycles, the actual mainframes, were really scarce. And part of the reason we had networks was so that we could all use basically the same computing cycles. So, oh, at 2 a.m., that computer's not going to be in that much use, so I'm going to wake up in my dorm room and log in because now I'm using those cycles. So there was this communal sharing of resources ethos underlying the whole thing. But then, you know, when really it was Stuart Brand, one of the merry pranksters and now a computer society expert. It was he who came into meetings on the West Coast and really told us, look, the internet is not for business. It's not for the Defense Department. It's for us. It's for us, the wild hippie culture of California. And we genuinely believed that the internet would unlock the wildest potentials of the collective human imagination. You know, James Lovelock had come up with the Gaia hypothesis, which said that the planet is one being. And we genuinely believed that the internet would connect up all the people into a connected, interactive global brain. And we would be able to function as a collective human organism for the first time. And it was a wild, really psychedelic, very trippy view of humanity. I mean, and that's part of why people like me from the early cyberpunk era were so disappointed when the World Wide Web became a kind of a shopping mall and we used all of these tools for surveillance and control. Once we decided that the net should be here to help people make money, once people were betting on these futures instead of just dreaming about the futures, then it became really important that we use these technologies to make people more predictable rather than more crazy. But the craziness is the part that was so exciting and I think can be retrieved. And I don't mean crazy in a horrible way.
No. In a kind of unpredictable way.
Right.
David Baker, though, those pioneers with all their creativity, did they bake in something that has come to be problematic? They wanted information to be free, and by that they meant free-flowing information, but actually it came to mean something else entirely, no money.
Yes, I think from the start of the World Wide Web, which for most people in the world is kind of the start of the internet, before then we were on the Usenet groups, we were on the IRC, the Internet Relay Chat and so, but the World Wide Web, as Wendy pointed out, really exploded the internet and brought it into many people's lives. From the start, we got this idea that we didn't really want to pay for anything on it. And I want to ask Douglas about this because I've always thought that was just an accidental ambiguity in the English language. Information needs to be free, or whatever the phrase was, which was a big calling cry of those early internet warriors. I think it meant that information should flow freely. There should be no restriction of information.
Well, it was
going
the first
the
half.
Internet.
It was actually the first half of a quote. It was Stuart Brand, and he said, information wants to be free, but it also wants to be protected. And that's the part that gets left off. And it was really the early American version of Wired magazine and that neo-libertarian urge that was saying, you know, free markets. You know, they wrote a book called The Long Boom where they said, you know, paste it on your forehead, you know, open good, closed bad. And the idea was that somehow the internet would be a technological kind of reification of the open markets that would promote, you know, a new globalistic economic boom.
Okay, well, I just want to bring Glenn Weil in for a minute. Glenn Weil, how do you look back on all of this? How do you think those early decisions, those early ideals have led to the warts and all internet that we have now?
So there's a lot of beauty and idealism, obviously, in the early internet, but it has a lot of historical resonances as well with prior periods that I think are important to remember. You know, the founding of the nation state had a lot of similarities. If you think about the founding of, you know, say, the French nation, the idea was that all these aristocratic privileges, all the serfdom and ties to this place or that would be wiped away, and everyone would be able to, as sort of a general will, collectively work together. And revolutions like that often run into difficulties, as we've seen many times in the past. And I think that the fundamental difficulty there is a failure to recognize pluralism and the importance of a variety of different types of human structures to allow people to make sense of the way in which they relate collectively to each other and to establish trust. And there's sort of a naive notion that if everyone could just be in touch with each other in some sense, that suddenly everything, all of the conflict, all the problems would be wiped away, rather than to understand that actually, and this was also part of the architecture, less of the World Wide Web, but of the original internet, to actually build things up as sort of networks, where you have different communities of trust interlinking in sort of a rich, dynamic, hierarchical way with other networks of trust. That got quite quickly lost in this notion of sort of just flatness, which is, again, as Douglas pointed out, very analogous to the idea of the free market, that this sort of flatness would make everything fair and open for everyone. And I think that's usually a mistake. If you don't actually build in the possibility of these many different levels of sort of structure, federalism, you know, civil society, different types of businesses, you end up with sort of an anarchy that gets colonized by a few large platforms, and that's kind of what we've ended up with.
He's absolutely right there. It's funny, what it reminds me of is a brilliant guy, a lyricist for the Grateful Dead named John Barlow, in the very early World Wide Web era, wrote something called the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. And he wrote it almost modeled on the Declaration of Independence. And he said, you know, governments of the world, you know, beware, we don't need you. This is our space, go away. We believed that government was the enemy, and partly they were. They were doing the Computer Decency Act. They were breaking into hackers' houses and arresting 13-year-old kids for doing internet pranks. I mean, the government didn't understand the net. But what we didn't realize was that by getting rid of government, we were creating a free zone for corporations to come in and dominate the space.
Do you think, though, that in a sense, that freedom is something that Silicon Valley, well, I think you've alluded to it already, that Silicon Valley, in a sense, would now be very unwilling to let go, despite the fact that people like you may be critical of where we've arrived? I'm not sure who's best placed to answer that. Douglas.
Well, I mean, I don't think that Silicon Valley wants freedom. I think they want certain kinds of regulation that favor the largest players. You know, we argue for things like net neutrality that will let anybody have kind of fair access to the same cycles and to the same bandwidth. You know, at this point, I feel like the largest players really want to privatize as much of the internet as possible.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and disagree a little bit with Doug and Glenn here. I'm not so unhappy with the capitalist neoliberal aspect of the internet, because I think it's generated a huge number of good products and good services that benefit our actual lives, right through from at the high level, as Wendy pointed out, you know, the medical sharing of a viral DNA to solve a pandemic, you know, right through to being able to contact your gran across the Atlantic. But I think one of the problems is not structural with the internet. I actually think the actual physical infrastructure and the coding infrastructure of the internet is pretty perfect. I mean, when Vint Cerf developed TCP/IP, which is a sort of fundamental protocol of how all this messaging goes back and forth across the world, he wanted to develop something very simple which could be scalable, and it scaled amazingly. He couldn't possibly have imagined Zoom conversations. He couldn't possibly imagine us here on this panel recording a radio program from many distant places using the internet. And actually, that's really worked. So I wouldn't want to disrupt the infrastructure of the internet itself. I think there is a political argument about the big corporations and how we imagined, if you like, a level playing field. And we've ended up with, what, 4, 5, 6 enormous companies dominating so much of the time and the data on the internet. But I think that's fixable. The trolls and the toxicity are a problem, but they're also a problem in the street and in the park. And we often think of the internet as something separate, but actually it's all part of human life. And if we're going to try and detoxify the internet, we need to think wider than simply the coding and the messaging online. We need to actually think in terms of detoxifying human society. And that's a big project, but it's a big project that, for example, Black Lives Matter are engaged in right now, physically in the street.
Glenn, do you think it is an issue then of politics, or is the internet actually a reflection of the wider world, which is dominated by corporations, free markets, capitalist in its tenor?
I would agree absolutely that we've gotten a lot of great services out of the internet, and many of those services have been commercial. The problem is not that we've gotten too many commercial services, but too few. We have a few platforms that offer actually a very narrow range of experience whose contributions to human life has been important, but in many ways quite modest compared to many of the revolutionary devices that were built, for example, on top of the platform of electricity. There's actually a lot of economic evidence suggesting that for all the hype about the internet, the actual benefits it's brought in fall far short of what reasonably could have been expected for its potential. And I think the reason behind that is that the structure was so thin that it didn't actually provide the affordances that we need for the public goods that would allow it to operate. You know, the people who run the SSL security protocol, it's basically a guy working for free half time. And, you know, a quarter of the commerce of the world is running on this system because there's no infrastructure to actually fund or support any of the key public goods. Wikipedia struggles. All the people who are creating content online are struggling. There's no structure there to actually allow the real contributors, who are not Google, who are not Microsoft, who I work for, who are not Amazon and so forth. The real creators out there are the people who are doing that hard work that isn't compensated and who cannot sustain themselves. And I think that's the really dark thing we've seen in the lockdown, is that while the tech giants have risen, there's massive unemployment, even though people continue to contribute value because they can't receive compensation for that value under the current architecture, which only allows those who dominate the whole system to profit from it.
A reminder that you're listening to The Real Story from the BBC World Service with me, Ritula Shah. And while you're here, please do hit the subscribe button so you'll get us every week. In our feed, you'll find last week's episode in which we explored the question of whether white solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement is really going to last, especially given the major reforms being discussed to address racial inequality in the United States and around the world. And if you've got any suggestions for future deep dive topics, you can find me on Twitter, at Rittler. But now, back to this week's guests. Douglas Rushkoff, author of Team Human and Professor of Media Studies at City University of New York. Glenn Weil, Chief Technology Officer, Political Economist and Social Technologist at Microsoft Office. And David Baker, a journalist who now teaches at the School of Life, a global organisation that explores the subjects of human connection and resilience. We've talked about the origins of the internet and considered some of the foundational ideals that have underpinned its structure. Coming up, we can talk a bit more about the problems, but more importantly, I think, at some of the solutions that are being touted which grapple with the structure of the internet. I think David Baker's already spoken about how perhaps he doesn't want to see too much change. But let's speak, first of all, to Professor Irene Ng. I'm going to introduce you into the conversation, Professor Ng. She's the director of HatLab, an organisation dedicated to developing the hub of all things, or HAT technologies. She's also CEO of the company DataSwift. Professor Ng, just first of all, what is the problem, in your view, with the internet as we find it now?
Well, the problem with the internet is that of representation. And representation is really important because, like every country, and I think of internet very much like a country, a society. You have certain rights in a country. You have a right to vote. You have the right to own property. On the internet, we don't have many rights. And one of the most fundamental rights on the internet is the right to own your own data. And I don't mean have access to it or be consenting for things to be shared around, but actually have the right to contract on our own data, to license it the way anyone can license data. If you're a corporation, Spotify licenses music to us, but we don't have the right to license our data.
Glenn Wyle, are you surprised that we were so willing to give away something? People didn't seem to understand the value of what they have. Perhaps they still don't. I suspect most people don't.
Well, that happens over and over again in history. You know, things that were once valueless suddenly take on a value. And a lot of profit is made on being the first to realize that. You know, oil, of course, was once passed over by empires sweeping through with no knowledge of the potential value it would have in the future. And I think you need to build consciousness and awareness of that. That's what happened for workers during the Industrial Revolution. And it's what would have to happen now if we were going to have a more equitable distribution of the gains from digitization.
The problem we're trying to wrestle with here is that individually our data, you know, I'm a 56-year-old man with dark hair and I have a small garden. You know, that piece of data about me is not much use until it's combined with the data of thousands, tens of thousands, millions of us in a kind of agglomeration in which patterns can be detected from it. So data is a very weird commodity. It's not like I have a barrel of oil here and I know the price of it. It's I have a very small amount of data, which by itself hasn't really got any value. And yet a big company, if it brings together a billion of me, has an enormous amount of value from bringing that together. And I think this is one of the problems, seeing data as a commodity, that actually it has value only when it's massed together with other people's data. So I can't quite work out, and I've been wrestling with this for 20 years or so, how my own particular data is valuable. I know Irene is doing amazing work in this, and I'd love to hear more.
Well, I don't think anybody really has a solution. I think the solution will come from the innovation of many. We created the ability for an individual to contract, and that's a very small part of the solution. Part of the solution is also the applications that want to actually build on a technology like ours. And we are very grateful that there have been quite a few. And of course, more recently, because of COVID-19, there is a COVID-19 application called ShareTrace built out of the US, rolling out to the city of Elyria within the next 2 weeks. It's a small little city, that microcosm of the United States, very progressive mayor. And I think we all work together to try to create that solution that really solves the problem of the internet in a small way, but, you know, hopefully will become bigger.
So it's a pooling of data, but you're not giving it away. It's yours. You have the Yes, absolutely. Glenn Wyle, I know this is something that you feel very strongly about and have worked on. I wonder what you make of Irene's solution and whether you think there are other ways to think about this.
I think in thinking about Irene's solution, it's really key to come back to the problem that David raised, which I think was really critical. And Irene mentioned it as well, that in isolation, individual data points are both not of great value and of potentially significant risk to an individual. Whereas in the whole, in a collective, data can be both valuable and potentially partially anonymizable. And I think that that means that property rights in a fully individualistic sense are not really the right way to think about data. Every datum about me is also a datum about other people. The emails that I send have a receiver. The social media posts that I make are conversations with friends. So they don't belong to me. They belong to a group of people together. And unless those group of people are able to bargain collectively for that value, they're not going to be able to receive any of that. And that might sound weird, but actually, if you think over the history of labor, it's always been the case that labor and you know, ordinary people, unless they were able to get together collectively, were overrun by a small number of powerful people. So while I absolutely believe individuals need to have an economic stake in the value that they're creating, I do not believe that that can be instantiated by a purely individualistic property right. It requires collective organization and collective, at least partially common ownership in order to have any real chance of delivering the value to ordinary people.
Absolutely agree. What we are trying to do actually isn't so much property rights, but the right to contract. I think for us, when you own your own server and you own your own database and you can license whatever is in it and you can put piece of music or art or data, the fact that you can contract on it makes the ability to create collectives. So what we set out to solve isn't so much property rights or ownership or you own your data. That could actually be something that falls out of it. But it was really around the right to contract on some content of which, whether very similar to banking, if I went into a shop and paid $10 for a thing, it's a legal contract. And the ability to do contracting that way allows that collective to happen. Right now, I think the biggest problem we have is collectives can't be made when there is no capacity to contract on the internet for individuals.
Douglas Rushkoff, I wonder what you think of this.
I feel like the problem that we're looking at is that the internet is really structured as a commons, yet we're trying to use the business models of scarce markets in order to figure out who owns what and who gets what for what. And I don't know that those are going to work. The internet, if it started as a commons, it started as a new digital media environment. And we're trying to use really the rules of the television environment in order to orchestrate what happens. You know, we're trying to turn the net back into television, which was about stoking consumerism and doing surveillance and taking people's data in order to understand them as consumers and then put things into their news feed to get them to become more extreme versions of their consumer selves. Yet the model that I think we need to use is less about who owns what and who's compensated for what than the model of a data commons, where we understand that, just as everyone's been saying, individually, our data is worthless. Together, our data starts to actually be worth something. And there's a few projects, like there's the Data Commons Project, which is starting with medical data and saying, how can we all share our data and in some ways devalue all of the data that the data companies have? Because if we're sharing it in a commons, it becomes a collective property rather than something that's exploited as data. And people who will make money on it are the people who are able to create value by analyzing the data, not kind of sell value by sharing their data.
I get Google Maps for free. I get to talk to my friends on Facebook for free. I get to show off on Instagram for free. I, you know, get to spout my opinions on Twitter for free. Why do I care about any of this?
Well, I think Doug touched on why we should care, which is actually, what are we giving up? What's the trade here for all of this allegedly free stuff? We're in a market here, whether we like it or not, of exchanging goods. And we're probably in the exchange at the moment of data for services. The real crunch thing here is that we've accidentally, and I'm pretty sure the early pioneers of the internet didn't intend this in any way, have created a surveillance society. That by all of this flow of our data upwards, not only to Google and Facebook, but, you know, as we know from Edward Snowden, to the NSA, etc., we've done a sort of trade-off of information about ourselves for these glittery services which come back. And this, for me, touches on a related issue, which I think is going to be very important when we look into the future of the internet, which is the idea of identity and anonymity. We're quite split as a society about whether we think people should be identifiable or not in their online life. On the one hand, we have the problem of trolls, of hackers, of other states interfering in other states' business anonymously and very in a way that's very hard to trace who those people really are. And let's face it, on our personal level, we experience this. People say things to us online which they would never dare say to our face. And we don't even know who that person is. They're hiding behind a username or an anonymous connection or whatever it might be. And on the other hand, we celebrate moments in online life when anonymity really works. We love it that dissidents can get information out about their societies, the abuses of the nations they live in, through an anonymous identity on the internet. We love the fact that, you know, very famously, the Arab Spring was associated a lot with Twitter. And a lot of that campaigning was done hiding behind the mask of online life. And I think what we haven't grasped is, how much do we want people to be like, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog? And how much do we want everyone to be identifiable on the internet? And I think this is a debate we're going to be having a lot in the next few years.
So, Irene, where would the impetus for change come from? Why would big companies give up access to data? Why would politicians who get a backdoor through surveillance and through security into our data and into information that data can reveal, why would any of those people opt for reform?
A few years ago, when everybody was building their wonderfully huge big data lakes and getting all sorts of insights and AI from it, fast forward a few years and all of a sudden these lakes seems to be a little poisoned. And I say poison just sort of by sort of illustrating the idea that personal data is increasingly becoming quite toxic to hold. We use the word plutonium, actually. You get it right and you get a nuclear power station. You get it wrong, you get a Holocaust. And because more and more regulations coming in to make personal data a bigger and a bigger liability, it actually makes sense to be held somewhere else. And for us, of course, we jump on it and says, well, you know, if your own user held it, this would be fine. And on top of it, we are great custodians of our own data. This is why we have our own microserver. And we can share it with you whenever we want. We will license it to you. And we are actually better to keep it safe because there's a secure infrastructure behind it. However, the contracts of which the sharing occur then has to be negotiated. But it might be worth it because big, big centralized data that holds that much personal data, parking it somewhere else might actually be more optimal as it grows so that the data can be better used.
Irene, can I ask you about this? Because as Glenn points out, data is not, it's not just our data. Data has meaning because it's interconnected with other people. You know, if some data about me ends up in your microserver because you and I have had a conversation on social media, or I've sent you some email, or I've sent you a bit of my data, then some of my stuff is in your server now. And does that really, that connection between the two of us is also data, but do I really still own that? Because now it's over in your pool.
I think you've got to be very careful about boxing what kind of data. There are many, many, many kinds of personal data. Of course, if you took a photograph of me and my friend, that photograph is, could be have joining rights, and there are, you know, all sorts of implications in there. But when I fill up a form and I put my first name and last name and I just say my age is this, my this is this, that's my data. You could start with the
I just have to disagree with you a little bit there. I actually would challenge you to find it a good example that is like that. Let me just take precisely the example that you gave. My mother's date of birth, I would put into many of those forms. Is that my data or is that my mother's data? So is my of birth my data or my mother's data gave birth to me on that date?
Okay, let me just clarify. You have to think about the way it is contextualized. If I'm filling up a form online and it's me filling up the form, there are all kinds of data. There's data that I generate. I could open the door and the door signal that I opened the door. There's data I generated, the data about me, there's data that's collected by me. There are many different types of personal data. Its source, where its source comes from. The intellectual property rights people know this very well. Copyright have been always talking about source data and everything. Obviously, there's a whole lot of issues depending on what kind of data. So let's not strip the data from its source and its generation. What I specifically mean is I go into an app, I run, and my running data, of which it's part of my run, and my name, goes into my server. That's my data and no one else.
I love your project, Irene, and I think it's very noble, and I mean that genuinely. But there is a problem. As you mentioned, you go for a run or you open a door, and we're just about to enter a world in which a lot of data will be generated by things. You know, we've called this the Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. So the door itself will be generating that data. Absolutely. You will also, in the park on your run, pass sensors, which, if you like, are owned by the park. Now, this brings up a really big problem that you opening the door, you running down a path in a park, that data is generated by an interaction between you and another entity, you know, the door owner, the park Correct. Owner. And it's hard to see now who owns this data or who even created it.
In today's world, the technology that generates it owns it. If you went to Tesco and you made a purchase that's owned by Tesco, whoever generates that data from Sensen kept it and owns the rights to it. And so if I have a server of which directly connected and it goes into my server and it stays in my data breach of which I have full ownership rights to it, then I own it. So there are many different ways of looking at it. What I want to emphasize is to not say personal data is a one-size-fits-all. There are many complexities about it, but that doesn't mean that we do not start on it. We've been working on it for eight years, right? We start with the simplest, and then we move
I'm going to close this conversation down, not because it isn't fascinating, it absolutely is, but it's one element of what we want to talk about today, a very significant element. But I think we've illustrated the complexities of this issue. I want to move on slightly and just talk about those who will be resistant to any kind of change, to even in a way this conversation, and whether we can get governments to engage, whether we can get consumers to engage. Is that possibility of reform of any sense, in a way, just pie in the sky, because the system as it is now works, albeit perhaps for a select group of people, but for those people it's working just fine? Glenn Weil.
The system is in about as extreme of a crisis as we've ever seen, really, since the Second World War. You've got unemployment levels that are unprecedented since the Second World War. You've got a Cold War between the US and China. You've got hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people dying of a virus. So, and you've got people out in the street in conflict. You know, these are precisely the moments when responsible elites say, look, to save the system that I've profited from, I'm going to have to change the way I operate. You know, John Maynard Keynes, you know, who founded the modern Keynesian demand management that destroyed old capitalism, was an ultimate member of the aristocracy. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the same. And they did it because of their fear of what might come otherwise. And I think we're very much in a similar moment now. There's all sorts of fragmentary regulation going up all around the world. And I think responsible companies will say, look, the way through this for me is to find a more sustainable framework rather than just let everything get fragmented.
Isn't there a difference of approach, though, to the governance of the internet, depending on where you are in the world and your place in the digital ecosystem? So if you're in China, you take an approach to the internet that's, let's say, surveillance-based. If you're perhaps in the United States, you see it as a place of a free market, and you know, free markets have driven innovation and creativity. Why would you meddle with that? And in Silicon Valley, perhaps you look back to those original libertarian ideals. Isn't that a barrier, a potential barrier to change, I wonder, Douglas Rushkoff?
I mean, it is. It's interesting. I love that Keynes was evoked, because, you know, Keynes lost at Bretton Woods, you know, when they were looking at the medium of money. Keynes was imagining something much more like an internet-style global money, but, you know, the U.S. one, with its, if we're ever going to peg everybody to the dollar. And I feel like even today with the internet, we're hoping, certainly in the West, that capitalism is going to solve the net with market solutions, which is why the only way we're allowed to talk about data, and we only make any traction when we talk about it as property. And when folks like me come and say, oh, but let's think of our data as a commons, it's like it's much harder for people to kind of wrap their heads around it. But I do feel that even though we have all these different systems of government that in some ways are all responses to the industrial age, that we're finally now going to be impacted by the digital in ways we haven't before. That digital itself has some qualities, some textures, some biases that have yet to be realized. And the more I study it, the more it feels like that digital retrieves medieval sensibilities, medieval, not just in terms of hands-on artisan, Burning Man, Etsy, and all that kind of medieval style, but medieval economic models, things like subsidiarity and distributism and indeed the commons. And the commons, as a way of interacting, as a mode of behavior, ends up really solving so many problems that trying to account for every piece of data. Did I get up on the left side of the bed or the right side of the bed? Whose is that valuable to? You know, is the mattress company going to want that data? And then do they give me a microtransaction on a blockchain for that? It's like we see where that's going, and those ownership solutions don't really work with a common resource like data, like the ocean, like the air. And I feel like the internet is a great model for the kinds of challenges that are going to be affecting us now as a global society. And the different sorts of solutions are going to emerge, maybe not from any one of our systems, but from the net itself.
There are so many interesting ideas opening up here, but we are, as ever, up against it for time. So I want to, in a sense, move really to think about the future of the internet. Its development, its transformation has happened at an extraordinary pace. I mean, Instagram didn't exist a decade ago, and I can actually remember explaining to friends what Facebook was, so it really wasn't that long ago. Throw forward 10 years then, bearing in mind everything we've talked about, what will have changed? Irene Ng, what would you hope has changed?
It's really hard for me to think about it because we are 2 weeks from rolling out the ShareTrace app. At least our partners are in Ohio across every airport, hopefully, in the United States. And we will then start to see if at scale, individual and their property rights really, really would work when everybody do get a personal data account. So I'm of course hoping that will happen. But as everyone has mentioned, maybe it's the property rights model, maybe it's the commons model, we don't know. What I do hope is, hopefully it would be better than what we have today.
Glenn Weil, are you optimistic or where do you see the change?
I don't like either the term optimist or pessimist because they're both forms of fatalism. I think the future is in our collective hands, and to the extent we collectively organize and can help reach consensus together around better approaches, which I think have to synthesize Douglass's focus on the, you know, purely commons collective and the individualistic focus that, you know, Irene has. To the extent we're able to reach that consensus, get past these divisions and actually come up with a new way of operating, I think that's the extent to which we'll succeed.
David Baker, I'm hoping you're still there. What do you think? Where do you think we might land up in 10 years' time?
Looking ahead 10 years is literally impossible. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, we'd never even imagined we'd be having this conversation. We couldn't have imagined Zoom, etc. Well, let's face it, we couldn't have imagined a virus like this. And so actually looking ahead is one of those activities which is more about dreaming, I think. And so what I would hope to happen is that we've worked out the issue with the difference, the tension between anonymity and identity on the internet. I think a lot of the toxicity on the internet, which I think is causing toxicity in human relations and in our societies, is down to the fact that a lot of people can do and say a lot of things with impunity. The real fear I have for the internet in the future is it'll become fragmented. As Wendy pointed out, China is already developing a different set of protocols because it has different intentions about how the internet should be used. And I'm a bit worried we'll have three or four internets in the world, which will operate in very different ways along very different rules and have very different feels about them. And it'll be quite hard to interact between them. And that, very sadly, I think will destroy the whole vision of the internet to begin with, which is to connect the world. I think we need to make sure we keep the internet as a whole rather than fragmented.
Douglas Rushkoff, where do you see this all ending up in 10 years' time?
I mean, it's funny when I think in 10-year spans, or even 20, I think of the 9/11 as a major inflection point for the net. You know, that 9/11 is part of what killed the party and let everyone justify moving into this surveillance landscape instead of the freeform creative one. And I feel like COVID is a similar turning point. But what COVID's doing for me, it reminds me of the day when I was in high school, my father found a pack of cigarettes in my coat and took me out into the backyard and made me smoke the whole thing. Now I feel like with the net, we're all smoking the whole thing all the time. And there's that overload. And I feel like what it's doing is helping us distinguish between what's the net good for and what is it not. I'm really glad to have it, you know, for my daughter to be able to get her lessons from her school. But it's not really working well as a substitute for the school itself. It's helping us realize, oh, well, school is great for live presence and the social reality and role models and establishing rapport and learning how to speak. The net is really good for getting a lesson, for getting the math lesson. And when we start seeing that, oh, you know, the net really, it's a poor substitute for human connection. I feel like in some ways the net's going to become a less social tool 10 years from now and much more of a thing, more of a work tool, more utilitarian, and real life will have reclaimed some of its social luster.
Thank you very much to all of our guests. That's it for this week on The Real Story. Thank you to Douglas Rushkoff, Glenn Weil, David Baker and Irene Ng. For this week, from me, Ruth Lachar, and the whole team, that's The Real Story. Thank you for listening and do join us again next week.